call is now being recorded.
There we go.
So, okay, so
this was a so I wanted to record it on Google Voice, and then I'll I'm going to use what I have. Hold on one second. I have my own recorder. Oh, it, I guess it doesn't really matter. I could do Audacity, but I'm just going to do oops, hold on a second. I'm going to try to do this here. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Shoot, I was going to try to are you using headphones?
I got headphones on, so I'm like totally immersed, I guess. And then
you're totally immersed in the electronics. Let me just try a headphone thing for a second here. Let's see if this works.
That way it's like you can't hear the outside world at least. All
can
great podcasts seem to have headphones. Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Here's the thing though, is like I'm using these headphones, but I don't know if the quality of the headphone microphone is any good.
It's not bad. I think the other was almost clear, but
yeah.
Who cares?
Okay, how's that?
Oh, that's really nice.
Okay, I'll do that instead. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just start my, I'm going to start my recorder here. Okay.
All right, I started mine, too.
You started yours, too? Okay. Now
yep.
Hold on a second. I'm just going to do a level check here. I think that's pretty good. Bump it up like one notch here.
I'm at recording volume 0.63. You know, so.
I got a mic level 79 here. Okay, so why don't we... I wonder if we can do something. Let's try to do something like let's both say 3, 2, 1, go at the same time.
And then hit record or okay.
No, let it record.
Okay.
At this point it's let it record, but this is just to sync it. So
yep.
All right, ready?
Yep.
Three, two, one.
Go.
Okay, hold on. We got to do that over again because that's we got to say
delayed
at the same
or something.
Time. I think. Is there a delay?
I don't know. We'll see.
Something's not right.
Ready?
Yeah. Okay. Three, two, one.
Go.
Nuts. I mean, I'm not getting.
Yeah, I'm pretty clean
right
here, so.
What's that?
Yeah, I thought that was perfect. To me, that was 3, 2, 1 at the same time.
Oh, it was?
We were spot on. Yeah, I could hear it perfectly.
Okay, then why don't we'll just, hey, you know what, the other thing we could do, here, I got an idea.
Try this.
I mean, we can kick that track, and we can kill this track and start over, it doesn't matter. Because in theory, it's like you're using the Google Voice just for the translation, but you get a higher quality editing of Audacity. You just sync it. Like there could be three people here and it would be, you just sync all three levels. That makes more sense to me.
What's that?
To sync the voices later.
Yeah. We can sync the voices later. Can you just like clap one time? I want to just.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. All right. I think we're going to, I'll let it go. And I think we're good to go. So how's it going?
Good. So at least we're down to actually trying something here and hopefully we make it over that.
We're trying to make a podcast. I don't know. it's still kind of an, it's still an experimental phase, but it's kind of a cool idea.
And you know, the key here is getting over that hump that the, you know, how to start a positive addiction. We have to get over that 20 podcast hump
in order to really establish. Did you like that? I sent that. I read about that today. People were saying, seems like about 20, you know, most podcasts will just stop before they even hit 20 episodes. So we could, we'll try for it. We'll keep going.
So it will be a little weird since I'm not looking at you, but I'm staring at a screen. So I don't want to be distracted.
Yeah.
But it is nice to have some notes up there, and you're wondering, you know, what is the cleanest way to do this, you know, as a conversation, so I don't, you know, lose my train of thought or lose my focus of listening. So what do you think would work best?
What's that? Just to have some notes on your computer?
Yeah. Do you think, you know, like having it open, but at the same time, I guess, yeah, you kind of got to just look around and have some, I'll have something to write with too, and that'll be good.
Oh, that's a good idea. Let me see if I can get a little writing utensil here in case we
come up with something.
I think as long as it's like not too regimented in the beginning, I think it'll be more natural. One of the things that I think I saw some people saying that what was bad was to, I guess if your podcast was not authentic, and I wasn't sure what they meant by that. And I was thinking of, well, maybe that just means that they had it like too perfect and too rehearsed and too staged.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of. Like if it's not authentic.
Oh yeah. And I think, you know, we'll just see where things go. And, you know, I don't know how, you know, I don't know when people do their podcasting, when you're strongest mentally. I think with your profession, you could probably stay mentally, you know, on top of things at all hours of the day. Whereas I'm kind of probably like,
yeah.
How about you? What do you think you're mentally best at?
I was actually just thinking about this today because I was, you know, it's kind of funny because I'm like, well, let's see, it's later in the day and I swam and then I ran in the heat and then I had a beer and I was thinking, I don't know, what if I'm mentally flat, you know? And, but I was reading that book, I think it was Originals by Adam Grant. I had mentioned it to you a week or two ago. And this guy says that if you're typically a morning person, you may have very good creative moments later in the evening. And it's something about how if you're just slightly fatigued, you might be open to different things. So, you know, not necessarily bad. I definitely do really well in the morning. Like I read well after a good night's sleep, if I do the first thing in the morning. But I'm also used to, you know, staying up and studying. So honestly, I don't know. It could be any time. If the conversation's good, I don't think it really matters.
Yeah. as long as I'm wide awake, then that's fine. You know, you get into the habit of the, you know, whatever habit you develop. Usually I put my kids to bed and I start to get tired. But if there's something to look forward to like this, I think I could be mentally on again.
Yeah. So, and I don't think that I would be up for anything. I don't think you would be up for anything later than 9 o'clock on any given night. Unless it's like maybe like a weekend or something like that. And I'm usually going to bed pretty early. So, you know, 9 o'clock or, you know, even, we can do earlier. We can even do mornings too, which is fine.
Yeah. We could do a morning session. That would be good at some point to see how energized if you're sitting there drinking coffee, you got some stimulants. And a lot of the other podcasters seem to be heavily stimulated, you know, or they're either drinking, you know, the Joe Rogan podcast, they're always drinking some type of coffee or some stimulants or some, just to keep that brain a little more intrigued.
Yeah, if you remember that Iceman episode, they were actually the Iceman was he was drinking beer, like one.
Oh,
after
he had beer too to relax. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that might be a good experiment. Like, you know, when I guess they have to figure out like what's the how do you decide what is a good. Like, what's a good outcome? Is it if the conversation is rich or if it's funny or I guess if you subjectively feel mentally fresh? Honestly, I think it, you know, coffee could be good. And I think that, like, having a couple beers, it's like hanging out with your, you know, hang out with your friends, having a couple beers. It's always a great conversation.
Yeah, social relaxing or, you know, something along those lines. Yeah, that's right. I should almost grab a beer. But, yeah, so anyways, yeah, I like the idea that kind of the M camp idea. And
yeah, I wasn't sure. I started getting a little bit, now I'm getting a little turned off because I was reading something and I don't know, I'm probably overthinking it, which isn't good, but I was reading that I guess like a couple guys were saying like, oh, you try to make it, you know, make the title specific so that people know what it is, but then there's like a lot of good podcasts out there that, you know, they don't have anything specific. They just have, it's like, you know, whatever, like Radio Lab or something. I think there's probably a lot of examples of things that are, you know, not quite as specific. So I don't know. I guess it could work, M Camp. I guess I liked it because it kind of, it was more of an acronym, like Colin and Mike podcast, and then the M.
Yeah, yeah.
As you know, I thought it would be, I had this idea to maybe not come right out and say what the M was for the audience. But I think that the M was kind of important to you because you kept thinking, well, there's this idea of the Mentat, which is this, human, superhuman creature from the book Dune. Which I think
yeah,
is kind of,
I think,
so I don't know that maybe that, and I guess that would be, that kind of leads into our, I guess the next, my next question, which is really like, what is this all about? You know, what are we doing? What's the purpose of this?
I think our goal is maybe to tap into our higher abilities or what human potential is and why do certain things interest us? Why do, you know, certain things disinterest us and how to, you know, how to live a life of some type of passion for learning and bettering yourself and others. And, you know, just looking at life more in a positive, aspect, but also being a realist, you know, and not getting caught up in this, you know, the standard issue, you know, news and politics and trying to come out with some outsider perspective or something. And hopefully we can get someone with you know, great ideas that we can actually speak with and ask questions to and, you know, stimulate a conversation that's, you know, be on that person's level. That's kind of the goal. You know, can you hang on someone that, you know, just wrote a higher end book? Can you hang on their level in a conversation for an hour and learn from them? You know, how do you question without interrupting? How do you go about this properly? You know, that's kind of my, I'm just kind of brainstorming here.
Yeah, I like it. And I would add to that, I kind of like the, I sent you an email about some quotes from Viktor Frankl, because I thought, I think this book has got to be one of my favorite books, Man's Search for Meaning. I don't know if you ever had a
recent
chance,
or is it a newer book? Or?
This guy was he's a psychologist that was in a concentration camp in during World War II.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So he was a physician prisoner in a concentration camp, and his you know, his writings and his revelations were, you know, pretty amazing. It's just like full of really amazing quotes. And I guess what the thing that I always liked about the book was that I think for like, you know, for a long, for, you know, as long as humans have been writing in recording history, they've always kind of had this question, like, what's the meaning of life? And I think he kind of flips it around to, like, you know, that's your question, is to try to figure out, like, what gives meaning to your life. And I guess it's different for everybody. But
so what gives meaning rather than what is the meaning?
Yeah, like, what's the meaning? It's different for everybody. And I like it because I feel like, you know, maybe this is, in a way, this could be a way for me to try to help answer that question for myself. Because, I mean, I have, like, we both have, you know, we have our occupation and we do what we do and we have our families and stuff. But I think that I'm always kind of trying to think, you know, on another level, like, is there more, or should I be providing more? Kind of always, like, questioning, you know, what I'm doing and what my real purpose is. And so I think is helpful about either writing or blogging or maybe a podcast would be to sort of clarify my own thoughts and my own questions. So that's just kind of everything that you said. But then this is kind of like a little bit extra of some stuff that I thought about. And maybe maybe this will, you know, we come up with something that is, it can be shared and then it's useful.
Yeah. So yeah, I like the fact that, yeah, we're trying to find what gives meaning to people, you know, in all kinds of different aspects. And then I think when people are passionate about, you know, what gives them meaning, and then it leads to interesting conversation, and
yeah,
you can become a good listener then. Like, if somebody's passionate about something, you know, it sparks an interest. I think that's why people listen to podcasts or read books or watch YouTube videos, you know, or motivational speakers, you know, to see, hey, what's giving this person meaning? How can I take a little chunk of that? And, you know, or add something to it. And I think, I kind of also like the idea in life of, you know, one quote I recently heard maybe a couple of years ago, and I kind of stick to it, is, you know, specialization is for insects. So, you know, just because you might be an anesthesiologist, you know, doesn't mean you can't be interested in something completely irrelevant from what you do for a living. You know, I think,
wait, what
in
was
our
your
society,
specialization?
No, the quote was, specialization is for insects. So my theory is, you know, I think, you know, having that well-rounded or overall interest in all different kinds of categories. So, you know, kind of a Renaissance man, look on life, you know, in today's world of ultra specialization in so many different facets, can you still be a generalist? And I think to be a generalist is important, because you can see the big picture then, and you don't get pigeonholed. You know, you can think outside the box. So that's what I'm always I like to challenge myself and question what I'm thinking, I think, you know. So how do you do that? And that's why I think you kind of seek out all these different authors, people, all this new information to find that answer.
You know, I always worry that sometimes I spread myself too thin, and I kind of take on too many things. Like, I've tried lots of different sports, and I'm kind of always switching around, and I know that some of the people that become, like, really, really great at some stuff are, you know, tend to stick with one thing, and then they get really good at it. I mean, not everybody, of course. There's examples where they have, like, they have a, you know, combined disciplines then leads to something new. But sometimes I worry that I'm, like, you know, I don't know, doing too much. But I think there's value in that. I think that, I like what you said about, you know, being a generalist. It's kind of funny.
Generalist, yeah.
Specialization is for insects. That's, it does make me think about, like, what my own work. And I'm actually very specialized right now. I'm just taking care of really sick, you know, babies having heart surgery. But I know that if I only do that, then that's not good, because I really lose all these other really important skills which are important in taking care of all these other patients. So I think, you know, the last thing I need is to get pigeonholed in my job. And yeah, maybe that's something that is applicable to, you know, just outside of medicine. People got to be careful not to get too pigeonholed. Like, what happens if, I don't know, let's say there's like a nuclear holocaust or your plane crashes on a desert island. It's like all of a sudden, if you're a computer programmer and then you're out in the woods or on an island, you don't know how to make fire, you don't know how to do anything. Like, I think it's good to have a variety of skills.
Oh, yeah, that's what I think, you know, maybe you're doing your Doctors Without Borders, you know, maybe keeps you like, hey, I mean, you're getting patients, you're in a, you don't have to worry about all the liability, hold harmless stuff, and you could, you know, one, you could be working with some type of amputee, the next thing you could be, I don't know, you could be doing, you know, doing something that you normally can't do that you're specialized, you know, you're given those chances to try that. And I think maybe, you know, little breaks from the specialization like that can, you know, bring back some of those basic skill sets so you don't kind of lose them or they go away. You know, I don't know.
Oh,
if
yeah.
You feel that when you did that?
Well, yeah,
did that help?
Actually, that was an interesting thing about working in Africa is that I really had to, I had to improvise because we had,
yep,
there
that's
was,
the word,
there were,
improvise.
We had
yeah.
problems that I recognized that I couldn't solve because I had either didn't have the right equipment or we didn't have the right, personnel. So for example, like I spent a couple months in Sudan, South Sudan, and we didn't really have a surgeon. We had an obstetrician, but we had a lot of surgical stuff. And so I did a year of surgery before I did anesthesia. And so I was
okay.
doing some minor surgical procedures that I don't normally do. And, yeah, I had to step outside of my, you know, I thought it was good for me because I had to step outside of my my normal
comfort
routine.
Zone.
I think that's, the comfort zone and then my normal scope of practice, I guess, is what I call it. And that reminds me, actually, I wonder if we have to, like, just kind of briefly say who we are. I don't know if we even need to get into that, but obviously I did.
No.
I did,
we could
I
touch on that
orders.
A little quick, yeah. And
yeah.
So, yeah, so anyway, so you get out of your, you know, your comfort zone, and what is it? Necessity is the mother of all inventions. So I think that's the quote, but I'm probably off on that. But it's like when your resources are limited and you've got to improvise, you know, and that kind of leads back to, you know, you kind of really get into that flow moment where you've got to rely on, you know, pure intuition and being in the moment. And would you quantify your levels of flow as higher in your Doctors Without Borders or, you know, a daily routine? I mean, you've got to be on because people's lives are on the line at all times. So I don't know what, you know, what would your situation be like? Would your flow be higher in Doctors Without Borders?
I love at work. I love discussions about flow. That's a good question. So flow, whether or not it was more time spent in flow because I was in Africa, I don't know about that one. That's a tough one. I mean, flow, from what I understand, it's typically where you lose track of time because you're really focused and you're doing your whatever it is you're the thing that you do. I mean, procedures. I get into flow and, you know, doing procedures and doing a part of what I do in anesthesia involves flow states, and then some of it's not. Some of it's not flow states. I honestly don't know. You know, it was extremely hot. I could tell you that.
Yeah.
Maybe less. I might have been in less time and flow, but I can tell you that it was very happy. Like, I think I found it to be some of the most rewarding medical work I've ever done. And I didn't really get a lot of sleep. I was on call every night. It was like 110 degrees.
Wow.
I was sick from the food. Yeah, it was like, it was impossible to sleep. We just laid in bed. I just laid in bed and sweat, and everything was just filthy, and people were extremely sick and lots of deaths.
Oof.
And, you would think that that was such a like a crazy environment that it would be kind of like a miserable experience being a worker, but I didn't find that to be the case. I found it to be actually more, I was more, maybe the happiest I've ever been. And so I don't know, like just, it was an interesting observation, just, you know, miserable working conditions, and yet I was happy. I mean, that's just, you wouldn't expect that, right? I don't know what that is.
I think
I find
externality
more
stripped away. You know, like you weren't bothered. You weren't bothered by maybe superiors or someone overlooking or malpractice or, you know, other stresses that you might not even realize are, you know, overlooking you in our society. You were free to just be respected for your skill sets, and you could then focus on doing your best and not worrying about the other stuff. And you know, people make mistakes. We're humans, so you know it's going to happen.
I think it was, there was something that was good about really taking care of people that they had no other alternative.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of it. I mean, at least for my time there, like I had, you know, somebody came in, there was a anesthesiologist there before me, and then there was one that came after me. But at that particular time, we just had our team, and then we were it for that village or that region in South Sudan. So you really did get the feeling like you were doing something. Now, a little bit is lost, I guess, in the first world medicine, because you know, lots of times people they do kind of have a choice, and then there's all these like extra pressures, like there's time pressure, production pressure.
Yeah.
There's legal, you know, liability pressure that I think kind of sour the
time,
richness or the,
would you call those
that?
The three? Is that medical lingo, time, production, and legality? Those are kind of the three cruxes in medicine.
Well, like
more?
Time, production, I say production pressure because you have to work quickly. So like, for example, there's, I don't know if I think a lot of medical people will have this, but I feel like it's really exaggerated in the OR because operating time is really expensive. You get a lot of people, and a lot of people are working in the operating room. You bring a lot of people together that
okay.
all have to be paid fairly, you know, whatever they get paid, fairly high pay. So, and then the patients have to pay like a rather high rate for, you know, every minute that they're in the operating room. That's a lot of time. So there's pressure to do things fast, get the work done, do a surgery, and then kind of get the next patient into the room. And that pressure is, you know, sometimes that in conflict with what doing safe, like obviously, like, you know, the faster you work, at some point you're going to compromise safety.
Yeah.
So, and then there's the liability thing, which I think most people would understand, liability, like you know, everybody makes mistakes in medicine, but you definitely want to, you know, be extremely careful and not have things go wrong. And then I think, what was the other one? Time. I mean, the time, I guess that was just the same as like production pressure. So like all that stuff they all have their advantages and purposes, but they can, maybe make they take away in some ways from the experience. I don't know.
It's hard to explain. Could be a way too with it could be a way too, you know, like even in the book flow, you know, you could take that time, production, pressure, liability, and if you break those, you know, how do you find flow? There's only so much time. How do you make some flow out of production pressure? You know, you could maybe find ways to find some type of positive, even though there's, you know, it's a negative circumstance, you know, but to make the best of it.
That could be a podcast all by itself, is just flow.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And incidentally, I want to say that I figured out how to say this guy's name correctly. It's Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi.
You saying this, his last name is still Mihaly,
like,
again?
Well, if you look at it, it's Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of like the end of his last name is got, it's almost the same as his first name. But I did listen to Finding Flow on an audiobook. And so, like, you know, the guy would say it over and over again. And I'm like, oh, so that's how you say it. Because otherwise, if you just read the book, you have no idea how to say it. It's like, who's that guy? So anyway, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. It's kind of the guy. I mean, it's a cool, it's a great book. It's awesome. I think you were the one that first told me to look into that. But I love it, and I think that's like I get some of my greatest moments of my life are because of being in flow. Whether it's, you know, skiing deep powder or buttercream, as we like to call it. Or
yep.
Doing procedures, or, I mean, I'm sure you have, you know, working on cars, you probably could just get, you know, have nice, like, long periods of flow, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think I do at times. I think I used to have more flow when I wasn't worried about time constraints of other things that needed to be done, where I would just could straight focus and not feel as if I should be doing something else. I think, you know, like, so hobby wise, I don't spend as much time as I used to in the garage.
Yeah.
Like those flow experiences, fixing stuff. Whereas I kind of get my flow now. I've always had a lot of freedom in my job at school. And now it's the kind of the, you know, the every day I'm always trying to, like, it's kind of an R&D situation. So that's where I get my flow. Like, whether it's learning something new for my electronics class or figuring something out or reading something new. We've got CNC, so learning new G code and just keep running experiments over and over to try to figure, you know, procedures out and how things work and interact, and like just keep failing, getting, you know, gaining ground, failing, gaining ground. And that's kind of how I get my flow now is.
Now what is that? Tell me what this electronics classes with the experiments, because I don't fully understand that.
Well, it's just a basic electricity electronics class, so any kid can sign up for it. And you're just going to start with the basic concepts of, you know, everything from Ohm's law, how does basic concepts of electricity, how does it work? And then we get into kind of the whole Make Magazine philosophy. So we learn by doing, and electronics components are extremely cheap to work with.
Yeah.
So, you know, what does a diode do? What is a transistor? What is a 5-5 timer? What is a resistor? How do these things work? And how can you, like, take this component and add it with this and make this light blink? How could, you know, and why does it, you know, why does the LED only light in one direction? How do you blow it up? Well, it can only take so much voltage. Well, how do we take 24 volts and run this little LED? Well, we have to have enough resistance. So again, it's math. And then we get into cool things where we'll actually, we build a little foxhole radio. So that requires no power at all, with a toilet paper roll and a razor, a blued razor, which actually, I got the idea because I was researching, I don't know what
this
it
is,
what
a radio?
I was researching. Yeah. Yeah. We actually build an AM radio on a piece of wood with paper clips, some basic, magnet wire, just anything. You could pull that out of any motor. It's just coated wire. Yeah, and it kind of blows people's minds because we build an antenna around the room, and I call it like the barbed wire fence. Like, we're all POWs, and we got to listen outside. So, yeah, and then we, you know, basically I have a little, it's what's called a piezoelectric microphone that I stick inside headphones like that you use for ear protection, so it gets really quiet.
Yes.
And it's a
piezoelectric.
Yep.
I think I understand the meaning of that, which means that you turn mechanical energy. It's a substance that turns mechanical
energy
into electrical.
Yep, pressure. So it's like a crystal.
Pressure. Yeah, well, that's mechanical energy. So
yep.
It turns pressure into electricity or electrical signal.
You got it. Yep, exactly.
So is quartz like a piezoelectric?
There's three or four different components. I couldn't tell you like three or four different versions that they use. So basically it's extremely sensitive. So if you put a small voltage signal into it, it responds and actually changes shape. So when it changes shape, you're actually bending sound waves against you. You're vibrating those sound waves. So you'll get you can hear that sound, that change.
So what's the thing that you put in, like which piece is piezoelectric that you're using?
It's just a piezoelectric buzzer. Like, so it would buzz in like an alarm clock or something. Yeah, it's a little like 90 cent part that you can get. I mean, it just has a very small, almost like a piece of foil over the piezo that kind of vibrates the sound wave. So it's very, very minute. It can pick up. It's very sensitive. So that's kind of cool to say, like, hey, this is picking up. And the first time people do it, you know, it's pretty like, whoa, what's going on here? And then in order to make a diode, we actually use a razor blade, and we blew it by using a propane torch. So what it does is it creates an insulator, a conductor, and an insulator. So you've got like a barrier. So you create a poor man's diode. So that's again like kind of that where we get back to that, you know, necessity. You know, like what can you make? You know,
yeah.
We have all this fancy stuff, but yet this it's still exciting to pull a radio signal with a toilet paper roll and wrapped with some magnet wire wrapped around it. You know, stuff like that is exciting, and then, you know, how does that work? And then you go on to the next one. But a lot of my inspiration comes, I think, from, you know, reading. I got a lot of technical books, and then, you know, I think the Make magazine and the Maker movement in the last 10 years has been a pretty big deal, because I think in the tech ed world, we're always project based, and it's neat to see like kind of a national scene of people figuring out how to hack things, you know, I like conversions. So how do I take, and one thing I'm working on right now is, you know, the old rotary dial phones. So we grew up with those. Nobody hardly knows those anymore. But, so I've got to take apart a rotary dial phone, and it's based on each number is based on how many times it spins a coil per second. So like, I can't tell you the exact math. So let's say you pull a three. It's like tick, 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 tick. And so you can actually have an Arduino for $20, an Arduino programmer, and you can program it to sense through those three clicks. So you could actually have a keyless entry to your house with a rotary phone. So again, it's like taking old, mixing with modern. You know, I get it. That's just like fun little challenges that I get excited about, like kind of MacGyver hacking style stuff. So,
and where do you get the ideas?
Again,
you said there was it's like in a magazine, or, I mean,
yeah,
I know it's
Make
from the
magazine.
Class, but is it, what's that?
Yeah, Make magazine has a lot of those hacking ideas.
It's called,
and then
okay, so it's called Make magazine.
Yep. And
okay. I got to check
and
it
then
out.
Sometimes
that's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. And there's all kinds of cool projects like you can build with your kids or by yourself, or people come up with their own idea. You know, we build one, sometimes three string guitar. So we'll actually wind our own pickup coils, it's a simple magnet and thin 42 gauge wire and wind 800 to 1200 turns around a magnet. And then it can actually pick up a signal then. And, you know, then we amplify the signal. And so just this little stuff like that, that's just the one class of electronics. And to me, that's it's a pretty gratifying class. And I enjoy that a lot. I get a lot of,
hey, that's
a lot
pretty,
of satisfaction.
That's pretty cool.
New to learn. Yeah.
I think I'm going to have to check this out. I've got to see the radio in action though, because that's pretty cool.
When you set it down on a table, it's pretty much like, what? That isn't a radio. Okay. So you hook it up and there it works, you know, so it's pretty interesting. But, yeah, to get back, you know, I think we were talking about,
what if you get podcasts without electronics?
Oh, yeah.
That might
with
be
a can and a string,
be...
a can and a string.
Yeah. I don't know how you,
one floor away, we could try it.
We have a podcast, but no electronics. We sit around the campfire. You have to come in person. It's like it's a non-electronic podcast that you have to show up.
Yeah, we're still waiting for people to show up. It's like an SNL scene.
Why? You know, why is
200 podcasts in, but nobody comes to the campfire?
Yeah, we have 200 podcasts, but we don't have any listeners yet. Why is it so popular? Like, podcasting,
I don't know.
It's just crazy.
It's just because
everybody's
you're
got
restricted
something to
in
share,
the radio,
right?
But you can, yeah, they got something to share. But the thing about a podcast is you can't fake it, and you get used to maybe someone is a great interviewer. I mean, a lot of it comes down, I think they're really interviewers, you know, they're having a conversation, but at the same time, they're letting that person, they're bringing out the most they can in that 45 minutes to 3 hours, whatever
right.
the podcast length is, of what that person can get across. And so I think people listen to podcasts because they are interested in some person or something. Again, you're only seeking out maybe what you're interested in, but if you like the podcaster, the guy that does it, so let's say you like Joe Rogan, you might just listen to a podcast that you don't really think you're like, are you going to listen to some guy that's the best bow hunter in the world? Well, why do I want to do that? Well, he's going to talk to him for 3 hours about this. And then all of a sudden you pick something out of it that you got to challenge yourself to, like, I think to listen to something that's completely out of your realm. Like, I don't know. I think that maybe that's, I like that a podcaster can be good enough to get you to listen to something that you are not interested in. I think that's when you really hit the level of a good interviewer, a good conversationalist. Do you think so? Or what do you think makes a good podcaster?
No, I think so. Well, I mean, it's the content, I mean, I guess the subject matter would be the first thing, but then of course it, you know, it's brought to life. Like I like that guy Wim Hof is a good example, and he's just fun guy to listen to. He's just he's got a fun, you know, with his Dutch accent. He's just fun to listen to, and I guess what I like too is that, you know, you with 3 hours is enough to really. You really get into the fine details, and I think that he got into this ice diving or swimming in the cold water because I think did he lose his wife? I can't recall.
Yeah. She committed
something,
suicide.
Right. That's what it was. Right. So that was something that was so intense. And so then he got into it, but it, you know, when you actually get to hear him say it, it's like, you know, that real, that was real. And that was like, he really felt something powerful when he talked about losing his wife that, you're not going to, you don't, maybe you can get that, I guess, from a TV show, but,
it's concision.
Like,
you
really
don't have
real.
You don't have that that time frame, you don't have the cut to commercial. You have this open conversation. He has the time to say that, like, TV is about concision and we're moving away from that. You know, like, you can't, I remember reading once, it was, I think Noam Chomsky said it, the one who throws the mud always wins in TV, because you could just say, like, that guy's a terrorist. He's a communist. He's a socialist. He's a Nazi. And then cut to commercial. Well, how do you prove in 30 seconds that you're not? But in 3 hours, you can pretty much, or an hour to 3 hours, you can understand where someone is coming from. And I think that's what people respect about podcasts is, you know, you can really kind of get to know that person in that sense of a time frame. I think that's what draws people, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's also that now it's really the ability to sort of for anybody at a very minimal cost to just start up a show and put it out there and reach the world. I think is an amazing thing. I mean, you know, 10, 20, well, maybe not 10, but 15, 30 years ago, if you wanted to have a show, you know, it had to be on the radio or on the television. And so that was highly limiting. Nobody would, you know, you'd have to really want to do it, and it was extremely hard. So there are, I guess there's like a downside, which is, there now everybody can do it, so there might be a lot of bad podcasts out there, but people tend to, you know, the good ones will rise up. So I don't know. I think you're right. I think the content's got to be interesting, and I think the interviewer's got to be interesting. Now, one thing I had learned about was not to make it too perfect, and I think that by that they meant maybe not too rehearsed, and then not too much editing. I hear some people will take out all the, when they say or and, or all the things that may not sound very, it may not sound good. I listened to myself, actually, when I recorded a podcast for my anesthesia fellows, and I listened to it, and boy, I didn't like the way it sounded. I seemed like I was stuttering, and but everybody else that listened to it, they said that they liked it. So I think it's dangerous. And I think that the podcasters out there will say perfection kills the podcasting. So it's got to be a little bit dirty, a little bit rough. So I like a little, some mistakes and a little roughness, I think is probably okay. And I think if I could take that take that back to what you were saying about being an interviewer. I don't know who the perfect interviewer, maybe he may not be like the greatest interviewer, but if he has enough time, you know, and then asks enough questions, I think eventually that information comes out, and it comes out, and I think it highlights the person's unique personality in there. And their background. And you and I have like these really interesting backgrounds, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely combining the two with your knowledge and more of the biological living field and all your experiences versus mine and the
doctoraling.
Physical. Yeah, doctoraling, and mine and the more mechanical toraling. You know,
are you a mechanical engineer? How do you, how would you classify your, I have to, like, forgive me, because I actually, I wouldn't know. I know you're a teacher, but you're also a mechanical engineer, right? I mean, you know how stuff works, and you know how to build things.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a mechanical engineer. My degree is in technology education. So, you know, basically I've got to be a jack of all trades. So we used to laugh and say we have to teach everything from molten aluminum to websites. So there's really no, like, again, that's like the specialization, or, you know, I have to be a generalist, but I become specialized once I get down into the different curriculums that I have to teach. So whether it's automotives or machining or welding or electronics or power mechanics or graphic arts, like, and printing, or, you know, like, it goes all over the board. So that's what makes it interesting, I guess. I'd probably be, I'm kind of like
about
a
electronic?
Oh, what do you mean electronics?
And what about electronic music?
Ooh, electronic music definitely interests me. You know, and you know, I guess we kind of have similar music tastes. Which,
I tried to. I've been trying for the last couple of years to learn how to create electronic music. It's one of my little side hobbies. It's not easy to do. I mean, in some ways it's the easiest thing to do. You have the software programs are so good now, but to actually make it really, really good and really unique is actually, I do find it to be difficult, but it's definitely fun. But I don't know. It's interesting. The technology keeps getting better and better, but you so rarely hear anybody as good as Kraftwerk, and they started making electronic music back in the 70s. I don't know how we, I totally like just dove off into another topic.
No, that's what I like. You know, that one thing leads to another. So, you know, on that tangent, yeah, it's like, that's where you have to draw the line. It's like novelty and newer isn't always better. You know, we're in search of that newer thing, that newer idea, which I think is important. But I think having respect for the classics, or just having that, you know, that whether it's in medicine, you know, what is the, you know, the ancient credo of, you know, do no harm, or I what is the main saying? The
ancient, yeah, the
Hippocratical. Yeah, you got it.
Hippocrates, and, yeah. You know, first do no harm. That's your primary goal.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think having a respect for the classics and then what is new, I think that's to me, that's a balance in life that a lot of people are missing. You know, whether it's the today's generation or our generation, or people are stuck on, oh my God, I got the iPhone 7. You have you still have the iPhone 4. How can you possibly know anything in this world? And I think what happens with that consumerism and the always having to keep up with the latest and greatest, whether, you know, you lose respect for what's timeless. So there are things that are timeless, I think, that are worth caring about.
I think you're right on. And I think it was this guy, Cal Newport, in his Deep Work book, also a really great read. But I don't think he coined the term, but he talked about it in his book. And so you have to forgive me. It was another person talked about a technopoly. And a technopoly is where, I think I've got this right, anything that is new or high-techy is considered good and better above all else. And I think that's how right now we see people responding. Just like you said, the new iPhone comes out, a new app comes out, like that application or this program is new and sophisticated and is therefore good. And we, I think only recently have really, people are starting to really pause and say, hey, is this actually, you know, spending this much time on an iPhone, is this really good? Is this good for our brain? Is this good for our happiness? And I think we're finding out some really interesting things.
Yeah, and is that technology giving us time, taking time? You know, there's always a positives to it, but I think we've got to, maybe it's kind of, you know, my personal opinion, but we've got to be able to have that choice to say no. You know, you have to be able to make your choice. You know, like the Amish make a choice to pull themselves out of a current modern system, but they're really about 50 years behind. You know, they use, instead of using electricity, they use air power. So they have giant compressors that they run all the machines on air power. So they'll run a generator that'll run a compressor. 50, and then they have,
they're
yeah,
50, 50 years behind.
Yeah, they're about 50, you know, in some instances. So they waited
out. They'll be listening to Kraftwerk in about 10 years.
In about 10 years. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, when we get the Amish to listen to Kraftwerk in 10 years.
Once the Amish start listening to Kraftwerk, then you know that.
Bootleg cuts that they turn by hand on a record so that they get you, it's manually powered. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Oh.
So they make their choice and doesn't take away from the community or their general life. But yeah, maybe you could introduce it. I cried. You have some on records. That would be kind of an interesting experiment.
Yeah. I actually have a couple of old records from, I think I got a couple really old ones. The old one might be 1905. I might have some from the 1890s. I actually have a record called the Naughty.
Oh, I saw those. I saw the Naughty 90s.
Yeah, the Naughty 90s.
The 1890s.
Yeah, it was the 1890s. And
yeah.
It was like printed. It was printed in like 01 or 02. But I might have a couple that are in 1890s, but they're real heavy, and you have to play them at 78 RPMs, and not that many turntables out there will do 78. But mine.
Remember, I think when they play like one song on a whole entire side, right?
Yeah, it's one song for an entire side. It's hilarious, and it's
so think about
the
sampling
so
rate, though. The sampling rate, the groove. If you think about it versus a regular long player 33, actually, I don't know if the grooves are thinner or the same, but you'd think you'd be turning that. There'd be more. It'd be more precise. Would it be more precise or not? I don't know. It's 78.
Well, I don't know, but I know that the records don't really skip. Whereas, you know, some of the newer ones, they get like a little bit scratched up. They skip like crazy, but these old ones, they're so heavy, and there must be like a deep groove because they're not really skipping, but they're made for a different needle. So I don't know if I'm ruining my needle listening to these things, but it, you know, it works.
They work.
But it's pretty funny because you put it on 78 and you actually watch the record go around, and none of us are used to seeing a record go at 78. I mean, you know, more than twice as fast as the 33, and the thing is just hauling. And we have people over at our house, and I say, listen to this, and take a look at the record, and they're like, whoa, where is that from? Pretty funny.
Yeah, I think I was there when you bought
yeah,
that collection.
I bought
of the oldest possible records ever in Ventura, right?
Yeah, I had a hard time actually walking to the car because the stuff was so heavy. I must have bought like 50 or 60 like old records, and I had a hard time carrying it. It's so heavy.
Have you found a gem or something that maybe nobody sampled yet in a deep electronic song like Dixieland Cuts? Or is there anything interesting?
I haven't gotten through all of them. A lot of it is classical. So I wouldn't.
Okay.
I probably wouldn't say that there's anything, no real gems or anything, but it's kind of cool to throw them on and then listen to them. No, I'll have to keep looking. But it's interesting. I actually have sometimes the new technology is not as good as the old stuff, like with the Kraftwerk example. The software I'm using to make this electronic music is called Ableton. And
yep.
Just recently I was on the website and I was downloading some new, they call them packs. Like I get some like samples and sounds and stuff. It was all free because I bought the software. So they have some new stuff and people are talking about how great the, there's like a new program, and there's all these new samples and new, you know, new sounds. And so I'm playing with it, and I found that I didn't get any closer or in any efficient way to making any use out of this new stuff. In fact, I think it slowed me down and it distracted me tremendously. And I looked at, I wound up going to a tutorial on YouTube, and I saw that it was a terrible video, and it was absolutely terrible. They didn't say anything really helpful about how to use it. And then all the viewer comments say, this does nothing but distract people from doing what is most important, which is making, like, using their time to be creative and make music. And so it's interesting because you could kind of say, like, hey, as an analogy, I wonder if that's kind of like a lot of technology. It's like we're being distracted, and we may not be necessarily doing anything really good. We're just like a little mouse in a maze. Maybe that's analogy.
From the Dune quote that, you know, that you put forth, it says, once men turned their thinking over to machines and hoped they would set them free, that only permitted other men with machines to enslave them. So right now there's...
I thought you'd like that. I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of that. And, you know, thou shall never make a machine again to duplicate the human mind. I think it went too far. But, you know, this author that wrote Dune, he's writing this in the 1960s. This is pre, you know, personal computer. Maybe there's some supercomputers with vacuum tubes taking up entire rooms. Actually, there's transistors at that point, but it's like to think that far out, and he's actually seeing what's going on today. And I see it directly with just students and people in general, and even myself, that unless I, you know, put restrictions on them, it's like the machines are highly addictive. You know, they grasp your interest. And, you know, see, some of it's positive, but, you know, in essence, you could be surfing the web into meaninglessness for hours and never bat an eye. I guess back in the day, we would maybe just stare at the TV and accept what it gave us. But, you know, now we have these choices, but again, we might have too many choices. I think that's one issue, is how do we narrow our choices? I think in this country, sometimes, you know, maybe if you're in a simpler culture we have so many choices that it actually, you know, becomes stressful. I just want to get a set of brake pads, or I just want to get a set of tires, or I just need to order the right microphone. And there's 500 choices, you know?
Yeah. And it's
stressful.
Yeah.
It sounds stupid. And, it sounds like white people problems. It's definitely a first world problem. Too many choices. And that's why I like that Cool Tools book. Someone did the dirty work, narrow it down. Someone picked my choices for me. I mean, that's why people used to hire an interior decorator or, you know, a personal assistant, you know, somebody that can help them, because there's too many choices. We can't possibly make all these, but, you know, we have to have time for those creative avenues. You know, if we're always trying to do these consumerist choices, you know, so make more time for your creative endeavors. I think that's one idea too.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And you mentioned like how addictive this stuff is, the apps, the phone, and everything. It's all done very deliberately to be highly addictive. The marketers and the programmers have done it deliberately to get your attention. And you have to have an awareness and then a lot of discipline. And there's a limited amount of discipline, I think, that you can have in any one day. So I found that I was actually did quite well when I went back to my, I did the Motorola Flip, or no, it was like a Nokia. I can't remember. It was a couple months ago. I have an iPhone, and I've had one for a few years, but I had to take it in for a repair. So I tried something out for a month, and it was definitely frustrating, but I just wound up picking up the, you know, I just would call people instead of texting because texting was so annoying. Mm-hmm. And now it's like actually a hassle to call people. And I think, boy, you know, we're on a dangerous road here where people are, would rather not talk to other people at a restaurant, or they would rather not call someone because the texting has become the preferred choice. It's really interesting stuff. Definitely, like, that's many books are dedicated to that topic.
And I think it's, you know, all these kind of issues have a long term, like, we're at the wake up point, I think. You know, the wake up point for kind of the revolution of this, kind of noticing this, might have been 5-6 years ago. And now we're, you know, I think a little bit of mainstream's waking up. It's kind of like in the 80s, you know, fat is bad, you know, fat is out, sugar's good, you know, processed food is cheap, it's healthy, all your nutrients are in it. And then, you know, fast food's not that big a deal. You can make a healthy choice on your own. And then all of a sudden the book Fast Food Nation comes out in 2000 and kind of slowly starts to change this perception. Well, 17 years later, good luck trying to get any junk food in any school setting. I mean, like junk in terms of like sugar. People are starting to wake up. They're seeing what's wrong. They're eating healthier. And now we've got this huge, you know, discrepancy, and you actually see it in the poorer you are, the higher levels of diabetes, obesity.
Right, where you're,
you can't afford good food.
You can't afford good food. That's really interesting. They can't.
Yeah, so we have the
good food.
We have
but if you go really poor, if you take it, I find this to be one of the most interesting observations is that, okay, poor people in urban settings in the United States, and basically they can't afford good food. But go beyond that. Go to a third or fourth world country, maybe not fourth world, but third world, where people are just eating kind of like rice and plants and stuff. That's actually healthier than just, you know, being poor in America. Kind of interesting. Do you see what I'm getting at?
And I see, you know, again, that gets back into our distraction, which leads to maybe the straight thing is willpower. And I don't know who wrote it. Maybe it was Cal Newport wrote in some article. You know, we only have so much willpower in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And some of us have more than others.
Well, he borrowed it from somewhere. A lot of his stuff is, he's put it in his book, but he did have a comment on willpower that you have a limited supply, and then you'll use it all up eventually.
Some of us have more than others, and I think maybe from time to time we should test ourselves and our willpower of something we really like. Like, I went like a month and a half without coffee, which I don't know why, but I did just to test myself. And it wasn't a fun path, and it took about a month before I really didn't care. And now I've slowly started to drink it again. And, you know, why not, I guess? You know, not a lot, but I did it just to see if I could. And that's kind of like something I probably am physically and mentally addicted to, because you got to be on mentally in a classroom. And I just did it to see what my willpower was. And I think kind of the whole, you know, maybe in the Wim Hof and the cold showers, you know, again, that's like a willpower thing, or it's you like
that's a tough
training
one.
For a marathon. It's willpower.
I did not do well with the cold showers. I'm thinking about trying to make another go of it, but I have an easier time actually just jumping right into the cold pool, like submerging myself.
Yep.
But actually stand there with the shower where I know that I could just do a flick of the dial and immediately it goes back to warm.
Okay.
I find that to be extremely, extremely challenging. And, you know, maybe I gotta get another.
Is that the willpower then? Does that go back to the willpower, like endowed so much, you know, and like maybe everybody's got their willpower, they're stronger and certain avenues. I mean, your willpower to resist gruesome and terrifying, you know, medical scenes I couldn't handle, or, you know, fear of heights I have. So, like, climbing endeavors you do, like, that's really pushing my willpower.
But you kind of work up to that stuff, right? So,
yeah, I guess.
I think that you can kind of, like, you got yourself off of coffee, and, you know, like, this stuff, like, some of this stuff that you're describing doesn't, it's like, it doesn't happen overnight. Like, you know, I didn't just, I see, you know, graphic stuff every day, but there was, you know, several years of college preparing for medical school and volunteering at the hospital, and then I became a EMT, and then, you know, then I worked at a hospital doing phlebotomy, and then I went to medical school, and then even medical school is like, you know, kind of like your first two years, you're not having a lot of patient contact, and so it's a very, very gradual, and I don't know if that, I'm not sure if that, how that relates to willpower, I guess, because, again, I think that a better example is just kind of like, you know, if you're already sort of addicted to something, like, say, the phone or checking the messages or whatever, I would have to think that probably most people, if you factor out or if you equalize it in a way, you know, make standardize it in some way, I think people have probably a similar amount of willpower. I think some people have better habits. You know, some people know.
Yeah.
They're aware of their, I think that was maybe the main point, is that
maybe that's awareness. Maybe people aren't, they're somewhat aware, but I think being that we're, I guess, in our situation of where we come from and our class background, and like, you just kind of, we found that healthier path, maybe through basically education, self-education, and then, oh, this kicked me onto here, that kicked me onto there, and where these people don't have that opportunity. They're kept, you know, you don't know that drinking, you know, 3 cases of Mountain Dew a week, yeah, it might taste good, and you get a little buzz from it, and you get some energy, but the long-term consequences, you know, just in terms of your sheer size, diabetes, you know, that you can get from this, I mean, you don't care or you don't know. And then I think, you know, sometimes we make fun of these people, or there's a huge underclass in this country that maybe they're just not educated on the correct decisions. And they're being, again, we're kind of being given our,
they're preyed upon
stimulus.
Big business, I guess.
Big business, yeah. Sugar's
right?
Cheap, so the poor have sugar, like Dr. Robert Lustig, you know. The ultra-rich have their yachts and boats, and the middle class have some meals and maybe a second home, and they go out to eat, and the poor, what do poor people have? They got sugar. You can always go get an ice cream cone, candy bar. You just go into, you know, if you need a cultural experiment, go into, I don't know if California has Walgreens, but Walgreens or Save a Lot of really cheap grocery store, convenience stores. Go to the gas station where people come every, you know, they're bored. So they walk in every 3-4 hours and they get a sugar hit. You know, they spend a couple bucks and then walk back home. I mean, it's cheap. You can get a hit on it. And, you know, it's destroying your ability to do a lot of things physically and mentally. And I think also, you know, kind of maybe we got into this realm because as you get to a certain age, you start to like notice changes in your body more. You're more aware of like how certain foods react with you. In your 20s, does it matter how late you stay up or what you eat? It doesn't matter, right? You recover.
You really can get away with a lot. But
yeah.
I definitely have noticed in the last few years that, well, especially now, I've got a couple really interesting observations with my training. I don't know if I told you I've been doing it in long endurance training, because I got like an idiot. I signed up for an Ironman triathlon, and now that I'm actually doing the work, I can't believe how how hard this is, but I've noticed a couple things with doing, you know, increasing my fitness and doing all this working out. My diet has actually changed all as a secondary, like, byproduct from the exercise. I crave the right stuff.
You crave the right stuff now. Yep.
I just crave it, and part of it is because I've noticed that I know that if I have like some dairy or cheese or something before I do a hard swim, it's going to upset my stomach. So that's something that I do because I know I don't want to have an upset stomach. But I also am craving stuff just because it feels good. And then for some reason, this is the weird one, but I haven't really been craving the alcohol. Because, okay. I don't know, for some, I guess I know that it's going to, I may not sleep as well, so my workout the next day might not be good. And also, I'm, like, more sensitive to it, so I just kind of naturally, I backed off significantly on it. So it was really interesting.
You want that energy. You don't want to be down, right? You notice, like, your body, like, hey, I had 3 beers last night. Had I had 1, this run might be a little easier. So the pain the next day, you're realizing that, and you know, that's helping you crave the right stuff, like you say. That's a good. I like that term. Like, how do you?
I don't know. There's like something more to it than that. It's something more like you're. It's on an unconscious level, like you. Because I feel like so after a really long workout, I feel like my body is just kind of buzzing all day. Like, you feel good. Like, you know, you have a good kite surfing session. Well, I don't know. Like, you have a nice surf session. Kind of like, it's nice to follow it up with a beer. But I guess for some reason, like, maybe the endurance training is different. And I don't know what it is, but it's on an unconscious level. I'm not really seeking out like an afternoon beer or anything. I want to hydrate and just eat like good food. I don't know. I think that there's more to it. We probably can continue to talk about that because diet and endurance training is definitely something that's on my mind a lot lately. That's
Have you
pretty
listened
cool,
to
I like it.
Yeah, yeah. Have you listened to the podcast with that Dr. Rhonda Patrick? I mean, she's out in the LA area. She's got some really,
yeah.
She's kind of like, I think a lot of it's kind of interesting. At least she's pushing some boundaries in certain things or new research and, you know, maybe not all of it's cracked up to be, but she kind of experiments with herself and, you know, gets different viewpoints from around the world. And I think, you know, I think it's very interesting what she's come up with. I've got a couple of interesting things I've heard from her.
Yeah, I listened to her one time on Joe Rogan, and I was, I guess I found it a little bit hard to listen to her, and this is not a negative against her. I think as just because I'm a physician, to hear, I think I would rather actually just speak straight, like, technical with her, because I think what she was trying to do is she used a lot of, she was breaking down concepts for, like, medically lay people. And I found that I had a hard time with that. So I might have to try to listen to some of her other stuff. I'll give it a chance. But I do know
like
that
I say,
he likes to have her on the show. So, I've tried to dig up. I'm not exactly sure what,
she does a Wim Hof
research
interview.
She's done.
She does interview.
Does she have her own show?
I think, yeah, she does. She has a bunch of YouTubes that she goes around and interviews, you know, people doing different medical experimentation or diets or, you know, she had one interesting one, something that I forget his name, he had done with eating within a 12-hour window. And in terms of, especially for endurance training, and eating within a 9-hour window. Basically getting back onto that circadian rhythm, you know, because if one thing we share in the entire world is light pollution and no circadian rhythm. Like, so, you know, obviously we're kind of humans running let's say 50,000 year old or, you know, to whatever you want us to claim 1.8 million year old software, you know, on 20th century hardware, you know, or something like that. Am I saying that right? Or would we be running the hardware with 20th century software? You know, it's so we've got these primal instincts. We're built and live on a circadian rhythm, but we've had full light pollution, you know, since, you know, for the last 120 years. I mean, there's really, absolutely, you know, if you go out in space, there's no place. I mean, you don't see stars at night. You know, we're not in tune with that that primal, you know, connection anymore.
Yeah.
And one of those, yeah, it's light pollution. That's why we're talking right now, because we can, you know, there's a light on.
I
can
lights
talk
on,
to
and I got my computer on. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yep. You know, so that's not natural. We should be asleep. You know, or, you know, like in the winter, we should be probably hitting the sack at six, and that's just the way it would be. But we don't, because so we extend out. But I think that one, she had some definite endurance training was good for eating within a 9-hour window. So even if you have your coffee, anything that the liver metabolizes, I thought that was an interesting, I think, for training.
So, okay, so let me understand this. When you say eating within a 9-hour window, does that mean you have all your meals for the 24-hour period within a 9-hour window?
Yes. So let's say you get up in the morning and it's 7 o'clock, and you drink a cup of coffee right away. It's brewing. She says anything that the liver, and then she's basing it off another doctor's research. She does a nice long podcast. Anything that the liver has to metabolize. So whether it's a multivitamin, anything, then that's when the clock starts and it shuts off.
Well, that'd
at
be
the last
4 o'clock
meal.
Then 7 o'clock to 4 o'clock.
Or seven o'clock to four.
Window.
So here's what you do. You get up and drink only water, essentially just drinking water until you want to get to that first, you know, zone where you can really hit it hard and get a good meal in. And then you can extend that 4 o'clock at night over to 7. So don't eat till 10, then maybe 7, but just try the 12-hour window. But the guy's saying even there's some slack, you know, if you mess up on the weekends, it's not that big a deal. But, like, if you can keep it within that 12-hour window, people are seeing a lot of, like, changes in their, you know, type 2 diabetes people and the way they're metabolizing. Endurance athletes are seeing a little better results. I just thought it was kind of cool. I experimented with a little,
actually,
but it's kind of annoying.
That is interesting. So, I'm up at 5 almost every day, 5 or 5:30, and I love to have a, you know, start off with a good cup of coffee. I definitely don't need to eat. I usually do because I know I'm going to be trapped in the operating room. And so I try to get a really, really solid breakfast in with my coffee so that I can kind of go a couple hours. But I think that I would find the biggest challenge to be, you know, we're usually eating dinner around 5:36. We're eating a little bit early because we have a, you know, a young child.
Yeah.
But I'm hungry again.
Yeah, you're hungry again, aren't you?
Already like 2 hours after dinner. Well,
yeah, that's the thing I think most Americans don't. Yeah.
I'm not saying that I'm not terrible. Like, I'm not eating ice cream or all kinds of sweets, but I'm definitely pretty hungry after.
Yep, I would be.
You know, after
an
early,
totally
early dinner,
that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, especially like I did. What did I do today? I swam for an hour and 15 minutes, and then I ran for an hour. Yesterday, I rode 60 miles on the bike. I was eating. I just wanted to eat like all. I don't know. I suppose that I might have mismanaged it too. There. I think that you're right. I think there's something to it, but I think that I might have mismanaged it. Because I even heard that after you finish a big workout, you really got to try to get refueled within. I think that first hour I think is pretty important, and then even the athletes are told not to eat. You know, not to be snacking too close to bedtime. So Yeah, I think
that's
interesting.
Yeah, so that they get. And I don't know what the process is, you know, what that last meal is, I guess. Yeah, I did for a while. I held off breakfast because we like to eat later. So you guys will eat earlier before the kid. We'll eat after the kids go to bed at like, no, almost like Spain, you know, like in, you know, Spaniards, like 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
We're eating dinner. And so my window is way late then. So I got to, if I'm going to play 12 hours, I got to play, you know, 10 o'clock for breakfast. So it's kind of annoying.
Well, we found,
that's hard to do.
Yeah, and we actually, so what we're trying to eat our meals with our daughter, and that's around the 5:30 time. And that actually feels good. Like, I like that. I could not do it. I could not go past 6 or 7. I mean, I would have to be snacking and then eating a big dinner late. I think I don't really like that either. So that's a tricky one.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Different culture. I guess it's what you get used to, but I don't, I haven't seen any bad results, but I guess I don't do a massive endurance training anymore. I mean, I guess if I start doing the Birkebeiner skiing, I could monitor it and see, see what happens next year. If I do it, I'll do the 9 and 12 windows and see like, hey, did my training feel better? Just do it and see what your training feels like, you know? Hey, did I feel better? Did I have a little more energy on that run?
Well, on the next show, we got to talk about the zone 2 component to the training, which I think is like that's the coolest thing. Zone 2. It's zone 2. Yeah, 80% of what I do is zone 2. That's 80% of what the top athletes do are in the heart rate zone 2. So it's low.
Okay.
Now, so that's pretty low heart rate. My zone 2 is about, let's see, it's like 110 to 125 on the bike.
110?
It's pretty
110 low. To 125.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure my zone 2 would have been higher when I was in college, but it's not good enough to just use that formula to figure out your max heart rate. Like, you can't just do 220 minus your age to get your max.
No.
And that that's a starting
somewhat
point,
close, right? The starting point, yeah.
Yeah. So I went ahead and actually got lactate tested. So where I was pedaling on a stationary bike, and every
VO2 max you did?
It's not VO2 max. It was called a lactate step test.
Fresh.
So I was getting serial lactate levels drawn from a finger stick, like the guy was sticking my finger and taking blood, while I increased the watts on the bike every 5 minutes. So my heart rate would go up, and then we were able to plot a graph where we can show the lactate levels at increasing heart rates and watts. And it's pretty cool. And once you have that information, then you know what your physiology is. And then you change your physiology by training predominantly in the zone 2. And it's been really cool. And I think we should jump into that next time.
I think I read a little bit about, a lot of people, maybe it was Phil, from that book from Chris McDougall, or was it Born to Run? And then he talked about Phil Maffetone, who trained all those endurance runners, and he trained them in that lighter heart rate.
Yeah, it came from Phil Maffetone.
Lower. They trained lower, like you're saying.
What's that?
They trained in that lower zone, like you're saying. I think that was, he was big into that, right?
Well, what happens is you get, when you spend a lot of time in that lower zone, you wind up just getting faster and better and at that heart rate. And so it doesn't really work. And I think, and this has been studied, but amateur athletes, like, let's say, for example, they want to do they want to qualify for a Boston Marathon, and they need to run like a 3:15 marathon to qualify for Boston, which is like a 7 minute, 15 second mile or something,
average,
maybe 720
right?
or something like that. So what they do is without, and this is, you know, again, an amateur athlete who's not really, they're not really, you know, studying or being coached or thinking that deeply about the training, but they'll go out and they'll just try to do these training runs at 7 minute miles or faster. And they have success up into a certain point. Once they get into they get their training runs up into the mid teens and they plateau and then they don't get any faster. So they flip it. They'll Phil Maffetone's concept of doing more is a lot of people call it, go slow to go fast. So you slow everything way down. Then what happens is the physiology is your body is just really relaxed. Like everything is easy on your joints, your ligaments, and you slowly adapt and you get faster at,
in the zone
faster
too.
At these low heart rates. Yeah. So you just keep getting faster and faster, but you're always, adhering to your zone. Now your zones do change. So that is something that you have to retest. And, that's another reason why to be careful of those estimations. That's pretty cool stuff.
All right, Mike. So
should we conclude,
or we can keep going? We can keep going in different directions here, but I think for a first one, just to
I was going to say that
get the audio. It was an hour and a half. Yeah, it went pretty fast. And I'm about to kill myself in battery here, so.
I thought we covered a lot and covered a lot of topics. We could I might try to listen to it tomorrow, and you know we could talk about you know what works and what doesn't work. But you know it was fun though. It was fun.
I feel like better too. You know, got my mind going a little more, and once I got a little warmed up and.
Yeah. I think it'll just get easier and easier. And I can already tell something for future is, we covered a lot of ground. Like there was all kinds of, we would kind of jump from topic to topic, which that's kind of fun because that's kind of like, that's real life. Like we talk, you know, this, that.
Yeah.
But I think that for a podcast, I think you might, try to stick within a little bit more of a narrow scope. Like there might be a theme, you know, mm-hmm. you know, like the theme could be like we had a lot of different themes. We had that was pretty cool hearing about the you know the electronic projects, like the DIY projects. That could be like a theme, or the digital distraction, or food.
Yeah.
Geez, you could talk for like multiple episodes.
They all kind of slightly relate to each other.
But
they do
kind of relate too. So I guess that's why it's tough to be too regimented.
Mm-hmm. And,
yeah, pretty cool.
Know, perfect. That was good. And you know, see, I'll send you the track, and then we'll see how the sound goes from there.
Yeah, shoot me an email, and then I'll play with it. So,
all right,
thanks, Colin. That was good.
All right, sounds good, Mike.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.